Hello and welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join Jack Stafford and Deborah Littleboy, members of the Etheria Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, mysticism, all of which are really only aspects of the selfsame quest for truth. Please note, this is an independent program not produced or fact-checked by the Etheria Society. Today we have a very special episode. We have a guest host, Julian Rosser of the Etheria Society, and his guest will be the Harvard scientist and director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at the Center for Astrophysics, Professor Avi Loeb.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Good morning from Los Angeles, Professor.
Hello from Italy.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Buongiorno.
The Italians are always nice to me. I'm not sure why.
Great. Well, I'd like to introduce you to a director of the Etheria Society, Julian Rosser.
Nice to meet you.
And I'd love to hear you two in conversation about, because Julian's followed your work for many, many years now, and he's got some really interesting insights about your work.
About my work?
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. I really admire your bravery on going, someone of your sort of standing in the kind of traditional academic world. Going out after the subject, and I know you've experienced, you've talked about the frustrations you have with people in academia, some people, and in media, and that kind of ridiculing the subject of this extraterrestrial life, possibly already having visited our solar system, possibly even there being evidence of that on Earth. And
I can give you a specific example from yesterday if you want, but
really, yes.
Yeah. Do you want to know that?
Yes. Yes, please do. Please do.
We planned the expedition to the Pacific Ocean to retrieve materials from the first interstellar meteor. It took us a year to plan it. And then 6 months after we came back with materials, we analyzed them in the best laboratories in the world, one at Harvard University using an imaging device, a mass spectrometer, another one at the Bruker Corporation Laboratories in Berlin. And so we came up with a detailed analysis. But in the meantime, during those 6 months, a few months ago, there were in particular a few astronomers who decided to argue that what we found was coal ash. And so one of them published in the research notes of the American Astronomical Society, published a paper about that. The other one wrote a long preprint that was posted on the archive. And both of them consulted reporters to say, that's all they found. It's ridiculous. This should not have been taken seriously from the start. So the reporters were saying that. Okay, so now we finished a significant part of the analysis of all the spherules. So I submitted a paper to the same journal that published the coal ash paper. And the editor's replies on just a few days ago, the editor says, oh, this is too important. Therefore, it must be refereed somewhere else and I will not publish it. So I wrote to the chief editor, this is the Astrophysical Journal. I wrote to the chief editor of the Astrophysical Journal saying, look, this is unacceptable. Science is supposed to be guided by evidence. And those people who wrote that it's coal ash didn't have access to the materials. They just expressed their opinions. How can one, the editor, publish that claim and decline the dissemination of information from a detailed analysis that took 6 months of the actual materials that were collected there? I mean, if the editor behaves this way, why would the public trust science? This is clearly biased, opinion-based, and not allowing evidence to come forward. This happened just a few days ago in the Astrophysical Journal. So I'm asking for this editor to be disciplined.
Well, it's wonderful to hear someone of your standing doing this, because the experiences that you're having are, of course, not new. This has been happening throughout history on this subject. There was one particular case. I'm from New Zealand. There was one particular case in 1978 there where a sighting was of a craft was seen by trained airplane pilots on a commercial flight into Wellington Airport. It was tracked on radar. There also was a television crew on board, and they had cameramen and journalists. And all of these people reported this incredible sighting. And shortly thereafter, we had people coming out saying absolutely insane kind of explanations that all of these people mistook it for migrating geese, for the planet Venus, for squid fishing boats. All of these kind of explanations come out. I mean, and it's absolutely ludicrous. But the problem is it takes the shine off the story at the time. And so it kind of kills it. And then when these explanations are later found to be ludicrous, it's kind of too late. The damage
is
done.
But you see, the difference with what I'm doing is I have the materials. We have the evidence. We have the results. So nothing takes away the shine of doing science properly. And so I'm trying to bring this to the forefront so that people will recognize the fact that within science, some of those people who claim they are protecting science are actually doing exactly the opposite.
And what do you think? Yeah. I think I know some of you mentioned that sometimes this could be academic jealousy because of the kind of attention that you're getting for the subject.
Right. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I don't care about their psychological motivation, but I think it's unethical for an editor to suppress the dissemination of data from materials on which a paper was accepted for publication in his journal without access to these materials. Okay, I'm just comparing two situations. One, people making a statement based on opinions without access to the materials. Second, another submission based on analysis of the same materials. And there is no, way by which any scientist can justify this editorial decision. And therefore, I say it's unethical. So
what do you think is behind that? It's like, this is not an isolated incident. It's
I
kind
think
of
this
culture.
Is, yeah, this is, you can call it bullying, the standard approach of suppressing something just because, first, you don't like the fact that it gets attention. Second, you might be jealous of the scientist who discovered it and you don't want that scientist to get any credit for it. It doesn't really matter to me what the motivation is. The bottom line is that it's unethical and should be prohibited. And there should be sanctions against those who practice this approach. Now, social media amplifies it because it's based on superficiality. So if you don't have the evidence, if you just have hearsay or one person claims that, the other another, then of course, it's just like politics. You can't prove your point. But I'm saying in this particular case that I'm talking about, I can prove the point. And I just posted an essay on medium.com about the latest results. You can find it. It's just from today, and also the paper itself. I very much hope it will be eventually accepted for publication because it's unheard of that in science, editors would behave that way. Behind it, of course, there is not just this editor. There must be a group of people who are trying to sabotage the scientific process. One of them actually is the one that wrote the preprint. He claims that he doesn't have time to attend to all of the results that come from my research. Nevertheless, that's the only thing he does over and over again. And so, it's really disheartening to see that. Now, all I can say is that what I'm doing, the scientific work I'm doing, is being documented. It's being documented, and as a result, those people who behave this way will not be remembered favorably by history.
Well, that's right, and I'm not a scientist. I'm looking at this phenomena and this sort of subject really from a kind of spiritual perspective, and I find although it's a different perspective to the perspective you're looking at it, I share a similar frustration. and that the view that I bring when I discuss this is a kind of spiritual in nature, and time and time again, it's just shut down and not even and considered as a part of this discussion. So although it's a different perspective, I can really relate to that frustration of being shut down. So what do you think we need to do to get to a point where we can talk about this openly? Because I think it's not just this editor. It's a systemic thing. It's been going for a long period of time, and it is peculiar to this particular subject. What do we need to do to be able to talk about it openly?
Yeah, so first I wanted to point out that spirituality and the frontiers of science have something in common, which is exploring the unknown.
Yeah.
And you have to be curious, you have to be open-minded in order to allow yourself to learn something new. And I think it all stems from the fact that a lot of people are attached to existing knowledge and to groupthink and to echo chambers, bubbles that they are trapped in, and anything that is beyond what they already know sounds threatening to them. And, you know, that's a very common situation, but you wouldn't expect it in science, which is all based on exploration. You might expect it in other areas of life. But unfortunately, you know, what these people are doing is suppressing the growth of our knowledge. And what I say at the end of my essay today is that, you know, if we ever want to be considered as an intelligent civilization, we must follow the path of, inquiry based on evidence without prejudice, you know, and which is pretty much what I'm trying to promote. So one thing to do is, of course, set the example, which is what I'm trying to do, and not be swayed by those bullies. It's not easy because they attack me personally on occasion. They interview with, I had the over the past 6 months, maybe 5 profiles in major newspapers, magazines like the New York Times Magazine and The Guardian, and just yesterday in the Chicago Tribune, and in the Daily Telegraph in England, and in a German newspaper. So in those reports, sometimes or often the reporter asks those critics who do nothing. They just send poison in the direction.
Yeah.
And so then the reporter behaves as if, you know, we need to show both sides of the argument, as if it's a political debate. Well, it's not a political debate, because what I'm, you know, doing is putting a lot of my time and effort to collect this data and evidence and do the scientific process, whereas many of these critics are doing nothing. They just express negative opinions. And this is quite unfortunate. Instead of everyone being curious, encouraging, because it's a lot of hard work. So in addition to the hard work of doing the science, I also have to cope with bad mouthing by those individuals. And they are very aggressive. I mean,
if I could just say, although, you know, science has at its pinnacle, in its ideal way, it should be, but science obviously has its dogma, and that's what you're experiencing. On the spiritual side, there's also the same thing. In its ideal, it is about exploration. It's about understanding ourselves and the world around us. But it too, of course, has its dogma. And so it's a similar kind of perspective.
Right.
But one thing we're also seeing is now, even in Congress, elected officials in the U.S. Congress are knocking on doors in the Pentagon and so on, and they're trying to find information about this subject, and they are getting, in their words, stonewalled. And the very stonewalling in itself is kind of making them suspicious. It's really, it's irritating them. It's almost antagonistic, whether it's intended to be that way or not. So what do you think is the motive there for withholding this information, especially from people like yourself, proven academics who surely would be deserving of this data if you're interested in it?
Well, I'm unclear about that. If indeed they have data, materials, they should definitely share it with scientists, because anything that lies outside the solar system, has nothing to do with national security. I mean, it has to do with humans everywhere, and that's the way science scientific knowledge is shared. So I'm really puzzled by this. I spoke with David Grush a month ago for more than an hour, and he did not provide me with any details. He said that he cannot disclose information because he would be put in jail. And at the same time, I had a visitor from Lockheed Martin at my home, and you know, we were discussing something else. But in the in passing, I asked him, "What do you think about what David Grush is saying? I mean, is it conceivable that the U.S. government shared materials from crash sites of spacecraft with corporations like Lockheed Martin?" And I expected him to say, "No, it's definitely, you know, wrong, and there is nothing behind it." But instead, he said it might not be wrong. And so I hear those people saying that, and it came from a variety of, you know, people with high-level security clearance, including the director of national intelligence, John Ratcliffe, a former. And so there might be something out there, but at the same time, it's not being disclosed, perhaps because the government is worried that the same information would reveal something of risk to national security. I'm not sure exactly what. The other possibility, of course, is that it's just like a patient-psychiatrist relationship. A psychiatrist never cures a patient because otherwise the paycheck will not come. So it's possible these corporations are not, you know, trying to block any dissemination of data about what they're doing because they are getting paid by the Department of Defense, and that relationship is very comfortable for them without scrutiny of anyone looking over their shoulders. But I do think that they may not have the qualifications. I do think that there are scientists out there like myself that could help them figure it out, and I very much hope that. Yeah, but it's not clear to me that, I mean, because I haven't seen any such data or evidence, it's not clear to me that it exists.
Well, there's certainly, you know, there's, I mean, I agree. It's not certain, and we are kind of, we need that, you know, it would be wonderful to have that that sort of smoking gun, so to speak. But, you know, the organization I represent, the Aetherius Society, it was founded in 1955 in England. And a few years after that, in 1958, its founder, Dr. George King, who was a master of yoga, he led a rally in Trafalgar Square, central London, calling on the British government then in 1958 to reveal the truth about what was then, of course, called flying saucers. And of course, he was dismissed. He was completely ridiculed as a complete crackpot at the time. But now here we are, you know, decades later, and this snowball is gradually starting to build. And we're in this position where elected members of the U.S. Congress are experiencing this stonewalling. So I guess you could say we're on a trajectory towards more information. If we were to put a timeline on this, where would you see us being, where we kind of have this great moment of revelation or of irrefutable proof?
Well, okay, so I'm taking another approach. Rather than wait for them to release it, you know, the sky is not classified, the oceans are not classified. So scientifically, I'm trying to collect data myself through the Galileo project and figure it out, you know, without, because the government cannot, even if they have some evidence, they cannot block additional evidence from coming forward, right? So that's an alternative route than asking them to tell us what they have, just finding it ourselves. But if they do have it, you know, it can happen any moment, you know, and it's really up to those who keep it behind the veil of national security. And my sense is it could happen within a year or two, either through the scientific inquiry of the Galileo Project or through the government releasing that we will know much more. So I'm actually quite optimistic because, you know, in terms of the science, it's a path that was not taken. So there is a chance of finding low-hanging fruit. Nobody did a systematic study of the sky, systematic study of interstellar meteors. So there is a chance we'll find really within a year or two something substantial. The issue is also funding. You see that, you know, I'm just currently waiting to, you know, for more funding for the Galileo project so we can maintain our activity for the years to come. And at the same time, you have funding of major projects which address questions that are not of great interest to the public. And so why would that be the case? You know, science is, or academia is supposed to attend to the public's interest. You know,
and surely this is the biggest question. This is the biggest question out there. I mean, what could be a bigger question than the possibility of intelligent extraterrestrial life visiting us or aware of us, interacting with us in some way, shape, or form? And when that does come about, the implications for our entire civilization, every aspect of it, are truly profound.
Right. And the other...
In your book, you talk about some of those kind of implications. What do you think are the most kind of profound implications that will come when we do kind of have this mass realization?
Right. So that I would split it into two parts. One is the secular and the second is the religious. On the secular front, you know, we could learn about new technologies, new insights into science, simply because the other civilization might be is likely to be far more advanced than we are because they reached our doorstep before we reached their doorstep. And so, you know, we had one century of science and technology, modern, since quantum mechanics was discovered. And they may have had 1,000 or a million or a billion years of science. So we could have a quantum leap into our technological future by learning from them. It's just like having a smarter student in the class. You can learn from that student. That's on the secular. And of course, you can make a lot of money if you import technologies that we currently do not possess. You know, whoever invests in this research could benefit greatly later on. The second is the religious aspect. And there, you know, I think we will be filled with religious awe when we encounter a more intelligent level of technology or beings, because it will be just like a cave dweller finding a cell phone or coming to a big city like London or New York City and seeing all the gadgets there. And
isn't there also the possibility that in addition, obviously, like this gap in technological advancement, I think is something we can all understand if we look at sci-fi movies and things, we can kind of see that. But wouldn't it also be possible that there's a gap in kind of thinking in a kind of, you could say spiritual or religious thinking, but perhaps in a kind of outlook on life, perhaps they are not just kind of benevolent, but a kind of, they don't have this kind of warlike kind of barbaric mindset of conquer and greed and everything that is so prevalent on Earth, that they may come with a mindset of a profound love, compassion, and a desire to help.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. So aside from, you know, meeting a superhuman entity, just the way that Moses witnessed the burning bush and realized that maybe God exists, so we would see something that looks like a technological miracle to us and get a deep appreciation of whoever is behind it. In addition to that, of course, just along the lines that you said, it will change our priorities. And currently, we are investing $2 trillion a year in military budgets worldwide and fighting on territory on this the surface of the rock that was left behind the formation process of the sun. And, you know, it's pretty much ridiculous given the amount of real estate that there is out there in interstellar space. And we would get a wake-up call by learning that there is a neighbor out there, and it will change our priorities, my hope for the better, and we would realize that we have to work together. And one way that I think of it is very often there is a talk about the Messiah arriving, and The thinking is that the Messiah is from this earth, but it may well be that the Messiah is extraterrestrial, that in fact, there will be peace on earth once we have a visit.
Could it be that we've already had visits? And in the belief system that I subscribe to in the Aetherius Society, we would say that these beings have already sent their emissaries in the form of Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, possibly Moses and others.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible it happened in the past. The only problem is it was not documented for us to examine the evidence. So we just have hearsay.
Well, yeah, all we have is, you know, for example, the Bible, we have the Star of Bethlehem, supposedly a star that moved and guided people. We have the Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel. You know, you could say that the Bible is an encyclopedia of flying saucer sightings, UFO sightings, yeah. UAP sightings.
One could say that, but I would much rather have, images and the data collected by instruments, which unfortunately we don't. So, yeah, I mean, also, if you think about it, human history is relatively short. You know, it's documented history is just 5,000 years or maybe a little more if you include the prehistoric caves obviously the duration, I mean the lifespan of the earth is 100 million times longer than our last decade or so, and it's really quite possible that there were a lot of visits in the past that nobody has a clue about. But the key question for us right now is whether there is evidence around us for visits. And that's the least we can do. So when Enrico Fermi asked, where is everybody? You know, he didn't engage in searching. And I find it surprising because he was an experimentalist. You just cannot expect the evidence to fall into your lap. You have to work hard to get it, and especially when dealing with such a huge space between stars.
Could it be that he, as he famously said, "Where is everybody?" We know from Star Trek, we have this. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Could it be that we're looking in the wrong way? And I know this concept of multiverses and parallel universes is kind of gaining traction. But could it be that from a spiritual perspective, we might look at the universe as kind of multi-layered and that different levels of vibration? I know that, how you probably see that differently as a physicist to how I would describe it. But could it be that on Mars, for example, the Perseverance rover is driving around, it's seeing rocks, it's seeing a barren kind of environment. Could it be that there's another civilization there on a higher level of vibration, a higher plane, a higher dimension, in some way, shape, or form that is extremely advanced?
Well, definitely. I mean, for one thing, we know that 83% of the matter in the universe is invisible to us. We haven't seen it yet. It's not found in the solar system as of now, and it's called dark matter. And there are lots of, puzzles about the universe that we don't fully understand because, you know, we don't know what happened before the Big Bang because we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. So you could imagine that someone who possesses, the understanding of how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity also knows what the dark matter is, what the dark energy is. That's the energy of the vacuum that is causing accelerated expansion of the universe. You know, knowing all of that could help you with your technology in principle. And we just wouldn't be able to notice things that are well beyond what, we know as of now. So it has nothing to do with a philosophical or spiritual thinking or with a multiverse, which is not accessible for us. It actually has to do with what is around us, but we just don't know how to probe it at the moment because we don't know what it is. So that there is substance called dark matter, which is just this way. And suppose it's being used in engines by extraterrestrials, you won't see anything coming from the exhaust of any vehicle if they were using dark matter particles for that. There is a lot. I mean, what we know scientifically is an island in an ocean of ignorance. So how can we make progress? Very easily. First of all, look around and see if there are things that are not familiar, okay? Like things in the sky that are not necessarily birds or living organisms from this earth. They are not balloons, drones, airplanes, satellites that we are familiar with, that humans produced. If you see something else that you cannot understand, that would be called anomaly, and then we can get as much data as possible about it, trying to figure it out.
But how do we go on from this? Like you mentioned Moses, and he had an experience, and let's just say that that was a legitimate experience of an encounter with a being, you know, from another world. How do we take that from this subjective experience that he had that was not documented? There's no data captured from it. And even today, so many people are having these kind of experiences. There's tons of people talking about this. They see things, they can explain things, and they feel things that are never going to meet sort of the benchmark that you're looking for, yet they're growing. And there's a lot, there's just more and more of these things. And maybe this phenomena is only going to kind of be provable in that way.
Well, there is a very simple approach, which is the approach that the FIFA, the football organization, adopted. So if they adopted it, surely we can as well in science, right? And the approach says you have a soccer match, let's say in the Women's World Cup that took place in summer 2023, okay? And the players say, we saw a goal. And the audience cheers on one side and says, yes, there was a goal. Okay, so you would say, okay, well, that's interesting. But FIFA decided, no, I don't care what the players say. I don't care what the audience says. I will look at footage from video cameras. And that's how they decide. Okay, this is the scientific method. And what that means is that if I was next to Moses, advising Moses, I would say, let me place infrared cameras around this burning bush, measure the properties of the bush, the surface temperature, which I can measure, the amount of energy per unit time emitted, and all kinds of other physical properties. And at the end of the day, I would be able to advise Moses, based on the evidence, whether this is a natural bush burning, or whether this is something outside of this earth that was created by a non-human entity, a superhuman entity that he called God. But I would be able to say this entity who created this bush that behaves in this way has technological capabilities of a certain level. Okay. And that is a tool that was not in existence during biblical times. Okay. So we made some progress. We can use instruments. If FIFA were to hold games during biblical times, they wouldn't be able to tell if there was a goal, okay? So we should be proud of the fact that we have instruments now, and those instruments are not subjected to wishful thinking, hallucinations, and other agenda that people may have, because we know that when there is a car accident and you have many people involved, they give you very different reports about the same event.
Yeah, we do. We can also have discrepancies and different interpretations of sensor data. And I think even with the three or four video clips that were released from the Pentagon and showed objects, there is just endless analysis and discrepancies and arguments about what they actually show.
Okay. So that is a very good point. That is simply because the data is incomplete and not of good enough quality. All of these reports from the past were anecdotal. Some military personnel happened to be at the right place at the right time. The Galileo project that I'm leading has a different agenda. It says, let's monitor the entire sky all the time. Why is that important?
Fantastic.
It's important because then you understand events that occur all the time. You know the background of events, and you can tell clearly if something is anomalous. And then if something is anomalous, you can say how anomalous it is relative to the background. But if you happen to be at Catalina, near Catalina Island, and see some TikToks one day and then never go there again or never do a systematic study, you don't really know what these may represent. And moreover, if you do it during business...
Yeah, some people's experiences are far more profound and longer, enduring, and you know, some people, they're more than just a fleeting light in the sky.
Oh, no, but
if you're, I could just, if I could just say another question to you. If there was, one of the, Dr. King, that I believe received messages from extraterrestrial sources, and one of these messages talked about how some scientists in 1954 had a high altitude weather balloon, and they sent it up and they had some photographic plates hanging underneath it, and a particle went through it, at which they, studied this. And one of the messages that Dr. King received said that that particle had been sent through these photographic plates by these beings with the intention of piquing their interest because it shouldn't have been there in the way that it was. And one of the people whose interest it caught was Oppenheimer. Could it be that even today, these beings are looking to gradually bring about a kind of gentle dawning awareness of their presence, and they are laying subtle clues? And some of those may even be to prominent scientists. Perhaps they are the laying kind of clues that can kind of breadcrumbs that can gradually bring the humanity as a whole to an awakening, rather than a kind of mass hysteria, perhaps even spherals on the bottom of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, of course it could, but I would like to see the evidence. I don't care who brings it to my attention, whether it's aliens or humans or just the U.S. government noticing something unusual. It really doesn't matter, as long as you see something that is truly anomalous, that cannot be easily explained as coming from this Earth. Okay, that's what I want to see. I haven't seen it conclusively. I don't want to rely on eyewitness testimonies because of the reasons I mentioned before. Sure. I just want to see the hard evidence. And if the U.S. government has it, so be it. I want to see it, and then I will help them figure it out.
Have you asked them for it?
Sorry?
Have you asked them for it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I publicly stated that I will be happy to help them figure it out if they have anything. But I was not presented with any data, so I don't know if it exists. And so the point is, I can potentially in the next 20 years collect the data myself through the scientific method. But if they have it, it would save me a lot of time. And, I don't want to waste my life on something they already have an answer to. So that's why I would be grateful if they were to share it, and I'll be happy to help in the analysis. But if they don't do it, then if the evidence is out there, then let's find it.
Have you ever had contact with those people in Congress who are kind of knocking on doors trying to get information at the moment, receiving briefings?
Yeah, I did have exchanges with, but I don't know whether they know exactly what government has. And that was the purpose of the Schumer Amendment, to establish a board that would oversee the process of collecting the information government has, and then recommend to the U.S. president what to do about it, what to disclose, and how. Now, this amendment was gutted in the defense bill of 2024, and the only thing that was left was the establishment of an archive that will compile whatever information the intelligence agencies or the military wishes to disclose. And we're back to the original situation where they can, in principle, hide materials or information just under the argument that it serves a national security interest. And I just don't know what they're hiding.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. We don't know what they're hiding, and the fact that they are kind of appearing to hiding something just makes us all the more interested.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it also, there is another path that, we don't have to surrender to the premise of waiting for Godot, the way that Samuel Beckett phrased it, where you wait your entire life for something that never happens. Instead, we can invest time, effort, and money in searching for evidence ourselves. And that's what I'm doing.
It's wonderful, and I applaud you for it. And I think we need more brave scientists out there pushing things forward in the way that you are, unafraid to be, limited in their career. Obviously, you're at the top, in a top university, and you're at the top. So you've, in some ways, you've got more to lose, but you've also got more credibility to leverage, as opposed to so many people on the way up. And but really, bravery is what it is at the end of the day, isn't it?
Well, thank you. I don't subscribe to social media. I don't care how many likes I get. And I chaired the astronomy department at Harvard for 9 years, the longest serving chair, the 3 terms. I was the director, the founding director of the Black Hole Initiative, a center that focuses on the study of black holes at Harvard. I'm currently the director of the Institute for Theory and Computation there. I chaired the board on physics and astronomy of the National Academy. So I had a lot of leadership positions in addition to being the head of the Galileo Project and the head of the advisory board for the Starshot Project to visit the nearest star system. And I know the system from the inside, and I'm not afraid because I know it. If you know something, you're not afraid of it. And I also know quite clearly what common sense says, that, you know, if you want to expand your scientific knowledge, you have to collect the evidence, and it takes effort, of course, to do that. And it's really a pity that this subject is not at the mainstream center stage of the scientific program right now, or and there are people within academia that are ridiculing it, because, you know, if this is a question that the public cares a lot about, the government cares about, and there is a good chance we'll make some progress in the coming years.
Yeah, it's a fantastic subject, and I look forward to your coming revelations with excited anticipation.
Thank you. So the latest is a post that I put out that includes an update on the analysis of the spherules, the molten droplets from the first from the site of the first interstellar meteor. And we found a type of material composition that was never identified before in the scientific literature. And, given the criticism that it may be coal ash, we compared it to coal ash. It's not coal ash. It's very different. We have 60 elements from the periodic table that we examined the composition of, and can clearly show that it's something new, not similar to rocks on Earth, Mars, asteroids. The closest it gets is to lunar surface rocks. But it doesn't look the same. So altogether, it's very exciting because it's the first time that humans put their hands on materials that came from outside the solar system, potentially, which, you know, is exciting irrespective of what it means, whether this object was natural in origin, which is quite possible, and I wrote a paper about it, or whether it was artificial, whether it was a Voyager-like spacecraft. Either way, you know, it opens the door in the future to study all the objects that came from outside the solar system and we find in the vicinity of Earth, to see, you know, whether all of them are rocks or some of them are space trash, because we are polluting interstellar space with spacecraft that we are launching, like Voyager 1, Voyager 2, Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, and New Horizons. These are 5 spacecraft launched over the past 50 years that will exit the solar system in about 10,000 years. And they will not be functional. They will just be trash at the time. So who knows how much junk there is in interstellar space. And every now and then, a piece of debris will collide with Earth. And, you know, these are just like plastics in the ocean. They keep accumulating over time in interstellar space. very different from radio signals that the SETI community for 70 years was searching for without success. A radio signal is just like a telephone call. You know, you can wait for it at home, but it may never arrive while you're waiting. Whereas objects, physical objects, you know, they keep accumulating over time in your mailbox or your backyard. And there is a chance to find them if you are searching. And so it's a completely different method. And I very much hope we will find something exciting in the coming years.
I'm sure you will. If I could just ask you one more question, I'm not sure how you're going time-wise. One thing you are surprised to read in your book is that you say we should at least consider the possibility that we could have been Martian in origin, in the sense that some sort of object could have come through and, as you said, sort of scooped up a bit of the top of a cappuccino, if you like, of debris as it came through, and that could have brought life in some form to Earth. Do you? Some people talk about the possibility of, and I would subscribe to this, that the asteroid belt was at one time a planet between Mars and Jupiter that was destroyed. And perhaps as part of that explosion, some sort of life came to Earth from there. What would you say to something like that?
Well, we definitely know that rocks from Mars landed on Earth. And then one of them that was analyzed about 40 years ago showed that it wasn't heated significantly by more to more than 40 degrees Celsius. So any biological material on it could have survived. There could have been microbes that were actually the first astronauts to travel from Mars to Earth, or vice versa. You know, so Elon Musk wanting to make the trip was preceded by billions of years, and so by these tiny microbes, that's a blow to his ego probably. But the point is that if we see that process happening with Mars, Martian rocks, and life could have started on Mars before it came to Earth, so we might be all Martians. And if we ever go back, it's just like kids coming back to their parents' home where they grew up, where they started. But in the same way, in principle, you can have transportation of life from other places in the solar system or from other stars as well. That's also possible. The only limitation is that beyond the 10 million years, life could be destroyed by cosmic rays in interstellar space unless it's protected very deep inside a rock. And but in principle, this process is called panspermia, and life could have arrived to Earth from elsewhere, definitely.
Yeah, fascinating. One day we'll find the answers to these questions.
Yeah, with respect to Mars, the most pressing question I have is happened before the last 2 billion years when it lost its atmosphere and liquid water on its surface. And so far, NASA explored the surface of Mars, but I'm wondering whether there is better evidence in the caves, on lava tubes on the surface of Mars. And in principle, if I ever have the opportunity, I would like to send a drone into one of these caves and the search inside of them for life that was preserved, perhaps because it's protected from cosmic rays by the rock above it, and also protected from the extreme variation in surface temperature right now without an atmosphere. And in particular, I would like to know if there are any prehistoric paintings on the walls of these caves, because that would imply that intelligent life preceded the on Mars. If it took half the time it took for it to develop on Earth, then Mars could have had it. It's just a factor of two, which is not huge in terms of when life, intelligent life emerged. And we just don't know if it happened on Mars.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been a big disappointment when we first got those photos of Mars, because prior to that, you know, a century or so ago, people really, the possibility of there really being Martians, literally people living on Mars, was a very real thing. It was talked about in media and so on. And then suddenly we have these photos and it's all barren. It must have been a big disappointment. And so that's where I think we get into this idea of life on different levels of vibration, different planes, different universes, parallel universes, however people want to describe it. I think is the key to understanding this.
Keep in mind that the Earth within a billion years, which is just 20% of the lifespan of the Earth will become very similar to Mars. It will become a desert because the sun will get brighter and will boil off all the oceans on Earth. And that's just a billion years away. And then the question is, if anyone visits our planet beyond the next billion years after that, will they be able to tell that we existed at all?
They'll be looking to send drones into caves on Earth to see if they can find rock.
Might still find the communication satellites moving around the Earth because they might not be destroyed. But there must have been a lot of tragedies throughout cosmic history on maybe even millions or billions of other planets that life on them went extinct because of the evolution of the star, because of some cosmic catastrophe. We are just not aware of it. We think that we are the first, that nothing existed before us. That's a very arrogant view.
Very arrogant. And I think that's the root of so many of these problems is this kind of human-centric mindset that, you know, we're everything. Everything kind of has to revolve around us. And even in the very sense of the Galileo project itself kind of stems from that concept of the sun must revolve around the Earth because we are the center of it.
Well,
and
if we don't, we just have
to gradually lose that crazy mindset.
Yeah, if we don't evolve beyond this mindset, we will not deserve to be called a truly intelligent civilization.
Absolutely. And in your book, you allude to that. You say there's certainly, there's an abundance of evidence to show that we aren't really high on the intelligence stakes as a civilization.
Right. I mean, humility is a sign of intelligence because you have a bigger picture in mind. You can be arrogant as long as you narrow your field of view just to yourself, which is what we are doing. We haven't really harvested much of the energy from the sun, even the fraction that intercepts the Earth, not to speak about creating things that we find around us. And there is a lot for us to learn how to create life in the laboratory, maybe how to create a baby universe in the laboratory. So, you know, one reason I am looking outward is to be inspired because, you know, if I open the newspapers every day, I get depressed.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Well, thanks very much. And thanks very much, Jack. I mean, it's been a real privilege and a pleasure talking to you, Professor Loeb. And I look forward to hearing more of you.
It's my privilege and my pleasure. I always learn from people I speak with. So thank you so much for the excellent questions and insights.
Thanks, Professor.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And if people want to learn more about the Aetherius Society, they can go to aetherius.org. Thank you.